Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chip Berlay, an author and researcher on bigotry and intolerance, who explains the dangers he sees in mainstream support for racism in today's Republican Party. Climate activists Jimmy Betts and Ellen Barfield, who talk about why they're engaged in an 18-day fast in protest of a federal agency's role in permitting natural gas projects that exacerbate climate change. And Rena Steinzohr, professor of law at the University of Maryland, who criticizes the U.S. Department of Justice decision to defer criminal prosecution of General Motors executives for a known auto defect that killed more than 124 people. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
More than 3 years ago, the United States and its European allies ignored a covert peace offer from Russia that could have led to the resignation of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Former President of Finland and Nobel Peace Prize winner Martti Ahtisaari told The Guardian that the U.S. and its allies on the UN Security Council ignored the proposal, believing the repressive Assad regime was about to fall. Over the last 3 years, over 200,000 Syrians have died in a brutal civil war, forcing millions to flee. Ahtisaari recalled that Russia's UN ambassador, Vitaly Churkin, laid out a peace plan that included Assad stepping down after a power-sharing agreement was finalized. In February 2012, Ahtisaari met with the five permanent members of the UN Security Council at the request of the Elders, a group of former world leaders that included Jimmy Carter and Nelson Mandela. There, the Russian ambassador outlined his proposal: a halt to arming opposition groups and immediate dialogue between the Assad regime and the opposition, which would make way for Assad to step down. Since then, the Obama administration has made repeated calls for Assad to resign, and the Pentagon has refused to coordinate with Assad's military in its bombing campaign against ISIS. In recent weeks, Moscow has increased its military support to protect the Assad regime by sending artillery units, tanks, armored personnel carriers, and enough modular housing units for about 1,500 personnel. With its allies in Syria on the defensive, the U.S. and Russia have begun direct military-to-military talks in order to avoid unintended consequences in the air campaign targeting ISIS. In late August, South Sudan journalist Moy Peter Julius was gunned down after he left the office of a weekly newspaper. Moy was the seventh reporter killed this year in South Sudan, which is consumed by a bloody two-year civil war. The reporter's death came days after South Sudan President Salva Kiir warned journalists, quote, "Freedom of the press does not mean you work against the country." Local journalists believe Moy was targeted for his reporting. Tom Rhodes, of the Committee to Protect Journalists, condemned the senseless killing, warning that journalists in South Sudan are increasingly self-censoring their reports, especially on the activities of the rebel insurgency. Under international pressure, President Kiir signed a peace deal with the rebels on August 27th, but has complained provisions of the agreement are unfair, including the installation of rebel leader Riek Machar as first vice president. Already, there have been a number of reported ceasefire violations, with fighting ongoing in the oil-rich Upper Nile and Unity regions. More than two dozen advocacy groups who work on behalf of survivors of sexual assault have blasted a Republican-sponsored campus rape bill for placing restrictions on universities and pressing charges for sexual violence on campus. The bill, known as the Safe Campus Act, which is supported by fraternities and sororities, would bar colleges and universities from punishing students for sexual assault unless the victim of the abuse first reported the incident to police. The measure establishes a more restrictive standard than for punishing students charged with selling drugs or committing physical abuse. Colleges and universities are obligated under the Gender Equity Law, Title IX, to address reports of sexual violence. But the Safe Campus Act would change that by requiring victims to report incidents to the police first. Kristen Hauser of the Penn Coalition Against Rape told the Huffington Post, "We don't force victims of other crimes to interact with the police and file reports and initiate criminal justice investigations." Activists say local police are often not sympathetic to rape victims. For example, women at Duke University complained police have accused them of lying or dressing provocatively when they filed sexual assault complaints. Currently, 136 colleges are under federal investigation for allegedly mishandling sexual assault and harassment cases. This has provoked a growing student movement demanding that university administrators address campus rape. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The 2016 presidential campaign has, in the view of many Americans, hit a new low with blatant racist attacks against immigrants, Muslims, and other minorities. Some but not all of the bombast has come from Republican frontrunner, billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump. Trump's campaign seeking the GOP presidential nomination has succeeded in leading the pack of 17 candidates on the strength of the reality TV star's national name recognition, but more importantly, on his blatant appeal to racism and intolerance. Trump's hateful rhetoric against Mexicans and his simplistic, fanciful call for the deportation of 11 million undocumented immigrants and overturning the 14th Amendment that provides citizenship to all persons born within U.S. borders has resonated with many Republicans. More recently, Trump refused to apologize for his failure to contest a statement from a supporter who declared that America has a Muslim problem, and then went on to ask, when can we get rid of them? That episode, along with a statement from GOP candidate Dr. Ben Carson rejecting the idea of a future Muslim U.S. president, exposed the deep veins of intolerance within the Republican Party. A September 1st PPP poll found Trump's beliefs represent the consensus among the GOP electorate, where 51% overall want to eliminate birthright citizenship, 54% think President Obama is a Muslim, and only 29% believe that President Obama was born in the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Chip Berlay, a former analyst with Political Research Associates, who has written about racism and intolerance for over four decades. Here he explains the dangers he sees in mainstream support for racism and xenophobia in today's Republican Party.
Corporate media, for the most part, just was covering the Republican primary hopefuls as a kind of sports reporting. There was no historic knowledge whatsoever. There was no reference to the outlandish bigotry of Trump, but also the bigotry of a number of the other candidates. Trump, by attracting attention as the kind of goofball, raising a lot of dust, basically overshadowed the fact that a lot of the candidates are part of the Christian right and are intensely either Islamophobic or homophobic, and many of them are anti-abortion. And so what we had for a very long time was a kind of mindless reporting of the jockeying for position without people stepping back and saying, oh my God, this is loathsome bigotry. We should stand up against that. And, you know, little by little now you're seeing more and more people writing about the fact that not just Trump, but a whole range of the Republican candidates have various forms of bigotry that I think many Americans object to.
Chip, what is your concern here in terms of this present day presidential campaign when you hear some of the hateful and bigoted rhetoric? What is the end result, you think, in our politics and in our society?
Well, the end result is violence against the named scapegoats. It's violence against our neighbors who are having targets painted on their back by these demagogues who are running in the Republican Party. And the failure, to some extent, of the Democrats and other portions of American society, you could argue that the religious community should be speaking out more. The issue here is that it's a long-standing social science theory that has been demonstrated time and time again since the Nazi genocide, that if you blame a group of people for threatening the existence of the pure ideal community, that over time, some people will interpret that as a call to go either beat them up or kill them. And that has been a basic theory of social science since the Nazi genocide. I have had editors tell me, editors who I have respected over time and who have published my work tell me when I turn in an article, we can't print that because what you're claiming is that this kind of rhetoric leads to violence, and that's biased. And I'd say social science isn't biased. It's a fact. You know, there are people all over the political spectrum who have proven this. And they go, well, we can't run your piece because it's biased. So it's the pushback from Fox News, but also a whole range of online right-wing, you know, basically bigoted sites that specialize in slander and degradation of some other, that editors now are afraid to even run basic social science.
What are some recent examples that we can cite here in terms of hate-filled rhetoric leading to violence? I certainly know of one, and I'm sure our listeners will remember, it wasn't just but a few weeks or a month or so ago that a couple of young white men in Boston claimed they were revved up to beat up some Latinos in their community as a result of what Donald Trump was feeding them in terms of campaign rhetoric.
Right. These are well-known hooligans in the Boston area who said to the people arresting them that it was Trump who made them move against beating up these Latino people and urinating on them, I might add, and that they were very proud of what they did. They see their arrest as a kind of a triumph of standing up ahead of the curve against these evil, degenerate forces like, oh, what's the long list, you know? Hispanics, Mexicans, Muslims, gay people, abortion providers, feminists, liberals, UN huggers. The list is very long, and it's bad enough in the mainstream media reporting these statements. But if you go online and look at some of the websites that support these candidates, it's really quite horrific what's being said. And it's bad enough what's being said in the posted articles. But the comments are astonishing. They really are calling essentially for the mass murder of whole groups of people because they're not really honestly American.
In your many years of studying these racist and xenophobic movements, what would you recommend as being the best method of confronting, challenging, and weakening these racist organizations and political movements in addition to the general sentiment that's out there in society?
Well, I recommend that people just strike up conversations with folks at the bus stop, on trains, standing at the checkout counter, their workmates at, you know, in the office, anywhere you can have a conversation with someone about what's going on. Listen to what they have to say. Don't trash them by saying, you know, abolish the white race, you know, end racism now. Say, wow, that's fascinating. I don't see things that way. Here's how I see it. And treat them with respect, knowing that you're not probably going to convince a person who's a dedicated racist or xenophobe or homophobe, but by respectfully engaging them in a conversation with a story about how we as a nation can come together and work through this period, then there's an audience of people listening and thinking about another way of responding to the crisis.
That was Chip Berlay, a longtime researcher on racism and intolerance. He's co-author with Matthew N. Lyons of the book Right-Wing Populism in America: Too Close for Comfort. For more views on bigotry and hateful rhetoric in the 2016 GOP nomination campaign, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On September 8th, a dozen members of the group Beyond Extreme Energy, or BXE, began an 18-day water-only fast in front of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission headquarters in Washington, D.C. Their demand is that the agency, known as FERC, stop issuing new permits to build frack gas infrastructure, including pipelines, compressor stations, storage facilities, and liquefied natural gas export terminals. Plans are to end the fast on September 25th, the day after Pope Francis addresses the U.S. Congress. While the natural gas industry and the political establishment tout gas as the transition fuel to move the nation toward renewable energy sources, recent studies have shown that the extraction process releases large amounts of methane, the main component in natural gas, producing much more greenhouse gas emissions than previously thought. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who's in Washington, D.C. in a support role for the FAST, interviewed two of the people who plan to fast for the full 18 days. We hear first from Jimmy Betts, who participated in the Great March for Climate Action, walking from California to the nation's capital last year. He's been involved in both of BXE's previous week-long actions at FERC and is one of the group's two staffers handling outreach on social media.
The reasons for the fast are to demand no new permits for fossil fuel infrastructure. And in the case of FERC, it's related to fracked gas infrastructure, pipelines and whatnot. But personally, part of my reasons for fasting, especially with water only, as the main idea there in terms of the tactic, is that water in and of itself is one of our most precious resources, and our existence is basically dependent on access to clean drinking water. It's indicative of what it's capable of doing for people. You know, we can live off of water alone for quite a long time, but the second that water is gone, we're down to a few days of survival. So there's a lot that can be stated about it in addition to the issues with fracking.
So how has it gone for you? You're on, you're finishing your seventh day.
Yes. So far, the fast has been going well for me personally. I'm definitely feeling my faculties diminished, and I, you know, can't walk as far as I normally do. And I'm working full time, so it makes it even more of a challenge. So I can't just sit back and relax. I have to actually be on it when it comes down to scheduling work for making sure that what we're developing here and the stories that we're being able to share are getting out into the world. So it's something that I have to balance out and take a little time off now and then to be able to do.
And what do you think has been the response of some of the people going by, you know, our FERC employees? And we can't always tell, you know, a lot of times it's just passersby because we're sort of in the heart of, you know, Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. here. Anything stand out to you in terms of interactions you've had with people?
My interactions have been fairly limited on the street. However, when I go into public spaces or like a cafe to do work on the internet, a lot of discussions come back to the postcard handouts that we have related to FERC or Black Lives Matter, depending on what type of thing we're supporting. And people actually actively talk about 18 days of water only. For what? So they're intrigued more by the action itself, and then they understand, you know, oh, this must be a serious issue. So hearing those conversations was helpful because you don't really know. It's like you're throwing cards into the ether, but people are actually reading them. And they are actually talking about it amongst their peers. So it's important to know.
So, Jimmy Betts, is there anything else you want to say about this pretty amazing and unusual and serious action that's going on?
Well, sure. One of the things that has sort of been an ongoing theme of our actions has been artistic takeaway pieces. And in this case, we have a project called the No New Permits Quilt, and it involves collecting stories from submissions from different frontline groups and also just concerned citizens, because there are many different levels of engagement. And this is one way for people who may not be able to fast that they can contribute stories, and we'll build it into a large quilt that hopefully will just be an ongoing project that we'll keep building onto. So we're looking forward to getting submissions from across the country.
We next hear from Ellen Barfield, a longtime peace activist, who talks about the fast coinciding with the Pope's visit to Washington and the need to take up the work for climate justice. She's engaged in a juice-only fast.
I really like taking advantage of the visit of the Pope. I'm not religious and mostly don't have much use for the Catholic hierarchy, but this Pope is kind of amazing. And if we didn't take advantage of the wonderful things he's saying about a lot of things, including the environment, the earth, climate change, I think that would have been very foolish. So it's good to be here amid a whole lot of other stuff happening.
What draws you to this particular issue of climate change?
Well, I'm primarily a peace activist and have been for 30 years. But I got to say that challenging the Pentagon is definitely being concerned for the environment, because they are a huge damager in the environment. But it's very clear that we have to get off fossil fuels. And to get back to the challenging the Pentagon, they're the biggest single burner of fossil fuels in the whole wide world. So, again, the two go together really well. My husband and I have chosen for 25 years not to own a car. We bicycle. We refuse to have air conditioning because it's such a huge suck of energy. You know, we're doing what we can. But until the whole culture, the whole world, gets it together and shifts to renewables and green energy from fossil fuels, we're just getting worse and worse. Individuals can do what they can, but we have to do it as a whole society.
That was climate activists Ellen Barfield and Jimmy Betts, who along with others are engaged in an 18-day fast in front of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission headquarters in Washington, D.C. For more information on the climate change protest at FERC, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Officials at the U.S. Department of Justice have opted not to prosecute General Motors executives for their decision to withhold from the public information about the installation of defective ignition switches into 2.6 million of the company's vehicles, a failure that cost the lives of more than 124 people and injured 274. Instead, General Motors will pay $900 million in penalties, enter into what's called a deferred prosecution agreement, and be monitored for 3 years. A federal court judge recently sentenced former Peanut Corporation of America owner Stuart Parnell to 28 years in prison for knowingly distributing peanut butter that spawned a deadly outbreak of salmonella poisoning that killed 9 people and sickened 714 others. It appears that new guidelines recently issued by the Justice Department calling for more rigorous prosecution of corporate executives engaged in criminal wrongdoing doesn't apply to giant powerful companies like GM. Critics say that the current system, which allows large corporations to evade responsibility for malfeasance that harms consumers, can be remedied by passing federal legislation that will make it a crime for corporate officers to knowingly conceal serious dangers that lead to consumer or worker deaths or injuries. Your reporter spoke with Rena Steinzor, professor at the University of Maryland School of Law, who explains why she condemns the Department of Justice decision not to prosecute GM executives and describes pending legislation that could ensure corporate leaders are held accountable for their actions.
Well, the problem with the cars was that the ignition switches didn't have enough torque. So what that meant was they had a very light trigger, and people were finding that even if they just brushed the key fob, these were compact cars, so they were a little close. They brushed the key fob with their knees, the car might stall. And if you're in the middle of the highway, of course, and your car stalls, you lose power steering, power brakes, and, as it turned out in this case, the airbags wouldn't work. So drivers were put in a position of maneuvering across lanes of traffic, trying to get off on the shoulder. And people were killed. 124 is just the number that GM has acknowledged. By the time all the dust settles on the lawsuits that are still pending, the number is likely to be at least twice that. So the company knew, the engineers knew, as early as 2002, before the cars even rolled off the line, that there was a problem with the switch. And they sort of didn't say anything about it because, of course, there's a lot of pressure to get new models out. And then problems began to come back, some from GM's own employees who were asked to sort of test drive the cars. So they began to get reports of the stalling. And instead of saying that it was a safety defect, they called it a matter of customer convenience that the cars were stalling. And what then happened was 10 years of palavering, having task forces and work groups and committees and subcommittees, and the company just engaged in this building sort of recklessness of not informing anyone about these cars.
As I understand it, General Motors will now be subject to a $900 million penalty and will be monitored for 3 years, but no executives will be prosecuted. Tell us about deferred prosecution and some of the objections that you have to what's happened with other large, powerful companies, as has happened here in this case with General Motors?
Well, they're really a very wrong way to go about criminal prosecutions. And deferred prosecution agreements have always only been around for about 20 years. On this kind of scale. Unfortunately, the Obama administration has been their most enthusiastic booster. You wouldn't think that that would be true in an administration that is committed to equal justice. We have, on one hand, the Justice Department talking tough in some cases, and on the other hand, letting a company like GM off the hook. And its rationale was that the company said it was sorry and that there was a gap in the law somehow so that it, the company couldn't be prosecuted. And while it's true that laws that deal with motor vehicle defects are weak and Connecticut should be proud, Senator Blumenthal has some new legislation that would plug that loophole, and I very much hope it passed. He's really been a consumer hero in the Congress. While that is happening, there were other laws that the attorney general could have used to prosecute GM, and it just didn't do it for reasons that are unclear. And the victims, of course, of the families who lost people in these accidents are very disappointed. They can't understand this.
Well, just a final question. What are the chances are that some new legislation that you referred to a moment ago, sponsored by Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal and Massachusetts Senator Edward Markey, what are the chances are that that measure could make a change in terms of auto safety, transparency, and public disclosure?
As for Senator Blumenthal and Markey's legislation, I'm hopeful it will get a serious hearing. But unfortunately, as we also know, campaign financing is so dominated by big business. And both houses of Congress are now controlled by Republicans who are hostile to this kind of reform. So I hope they're both very skilled and talented legislators, and I hope that they can meet this challenge. But it's going to be a rough going.
That was Rena Steinsor, professor of law at the University of Maryland, and author of the book, Why Not Jail? Industrial Catastrophes, Corporate Malfeasance, and Government Inaction. Find more views on corporate crime and accountability by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Richard Hill, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.